Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Okay. So I want to thank you for agreeing to do the interview with me for our Reparative Histories and the Black Experience at UMD Oral History Project. Mr. Nguyen, what's your hometown?
I live in Washington, D.C. I'm originally from a little town in Southwest Virginia called Blackstone. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland.
So you've kind of been all over the DMV.
Well, my family was part of the Great Migration from the South to the North, you know, back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. When's your birthday?
November 5th, 1944.
Okay. Could you talk to me a little bit about your life prior to coming to the University of Maryland?
Well, yes. I went to, I'll start with high school. I went to a high school called Baltimore City College High School, which was a college prep school, all boys school, predominantly Jewish, Italian, and a few Polish people going there, and a few blacks. I was one of the few. And I became quite friendly with the Jewish guys who were at my school, because I kind of lived on the fringe of the neighborhood that they were coming from. When I graduated, all of my friends who happened to be Jewish were going to the University of Maryland. All of my friends who happened to be black, seems as though they were going to Morgan State or Virginia State College. Historical black colleges.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the University of Maryland because I thought it would be cool to be with my Jewish friends, only to get there and find out after the first couple of weeks when they were having fraternity rush, which I attended some of their celebrations,
mm-hmm.
and everyone looked at me as though I was out of place, because I was usually the only, I was the only black that was at fraternity rush.
Mm.
And that's when I got the feeling of abandonment by my Jewish friends, who I was real tight with in high school, but when I got to college, I was kind of like I was a person non grata. But that's how I ended up at the University of Maryland.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about your parents or your guardian's background?
My mother was a very smart woman. She too was from Blackstone, Virginia. However, she grew up during a period of time when blacks could only go to the ninth grade. They call it the Blackstone Normal Training School.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, even though she was a very intelligent woman and a very good artist too, she didn't have the resources to go to another city so that she could finish high school and go on to college. So she became a waitress, and that's what she did for most of her life.
Mm-hmm.
Never made over a dollar an hour, excluding tips. She was a very good singer. I would put her up there with Mahalia Jackson in terms of songs. very much a Christian lady. My father grew up in the same town, same situation. When he got to the ninth grade, that was the end of school for him. He became a truck driver, never earned over $2 an hour. But at some point in life, the two of them separated. They never divorced. My mother moved to Baltimore, hence that's how I ended up in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And my father ended up continuing to live in Blackstone, Virginia.
You told me a little about how you came to enroll at the University of Maryland, but how did you come to decide what you were going to major in?
Well, I've always had an interest in finance. I had some uncles. One had a bar and nightclub in Baltimore. His name was Joseph Knight, and he was also a very good friend of Joe Louis, the famous boxer. So I had an opportunity to rub elbows with him. That same uncle also owned a funeral home, and my part-time job there was to wash the family cars, the ambulance, et cetera, the hearse, and get it prepared for funerals. I had another uncle who was in the, what they call the numbers business in Baltimore. And it was my responsibility to count the coins and the dollar bills that he took in on a daily basis from his number business, which was illegal at the time, the number business that is, until the state of Maryland found fit to make it legalized. But you had to have a store in order to be able to sell the numbers. Mm-hmm. And if you were a person of color, it was considered to be an outlaw if you were doing the number business illegally. So I had a part-time job working in the nightclub as a bar boy. That is, you supplied the bars with ice and clean glasses, etc. I worked in the kitchen, helping to do prep work. I ran the barbecue stand that he also had, one of them had, outside of the nightclub. So I guess you might say I've always been a hustler all my life, and I learned it from them. So I decided to major in economics and poli-sci when I went to the University of Maryland. I've always had an interest in politics, and I've also always had an interest in money since I came from a not-so-well-to-do background financially.
You talked to me a little about kind of how you experienced the campus in the first couple of weeks, but do you remember what it was like to walk on campus for the very first time as a freshman?
Well, some of it was kind of stupid from my perspective, because I've always acted older than my age. Mm-hmm. When you're growing up and your parents are separated, it requires you to be an adult and make your own decisions somewhat. So the first thing they wanted me to do when I got on campus was to wear a beanie to signify that I was a freshman. And, of course, they would make fun of you during that period of time. But I never wore a beanie and refused to do so. So that's what it felt like. What it feels like now, I don't get a warm and fuzzy feeling when I go to the University of Maryland. And it often makes me wish that I had gone to a historical black college instead of going there, considering my experiences there. My friends that I went to high school with, and relatives as well, who went to historical black colleges, one of their great traditions is homecoming. Mm-hmm. They always look forward to going to homecoming. You know, you gotta do it upright when you show up for homecoming. It's always a big deal. But at the University of Maryland, the first time I went to homecoming in my freshman year, I was sitting in a section. It seems like I was the only black person in the stadium at that time, and I got into a fight with a white guy who was sitting behind me, and he poured Coca-Cola on my new suede jacket. Mm. Because, quote, he said, they didn't want any niggers sitting in the section that they were in. So we got into a fight, and that was my first homecoming and my last homecoming. And it was a rude awakening at the situation I put myself in. I felt like I was in the deep, deep South again.
When you attended University of Maryland, did you live on campus? And if so, which residence hall?
I lived on campus one semester. That was in Calvert Hall. And the reason why it was only one semester was because, once again, I was the only black in the dorm. And I had a part-time job at Baltimore that I would go to on the weekends. And I would come back, and sometimes there would be water in my bed or a water bucket on the door. You open the door, and the water would fall on you. There were some people who pretended to be relatives of Hitler and act accordingly, particularly when we had the dorm meetings. And so I decided that that was not a good place for me to be in, and I started looking for an apartment. I went to University Hills, naively thinking that I could get an apartment there. However, I went to the rental office and they threw me out, which was another rude awakening at the University of Maryland. So then I commuted the second semester from Baltimore of the first year. And then during the summer, I was able to find an apartment to rent on Rhode Island Avenue in DC. And that was where I lived until I graduated from the University of Maryland.
I know of, and we'll definitely talk about your involvement in CORE and the Black Student Union, but was CORE the first sort of student or civic organization you belonged to on campus?
Yes, and once again, it was only three of us who happened to be black at that particular time. Myself, a guy named Dave Boston, who was, I believe he was a senior when I was a freshman, and another brother named Melvin Patillo. They were the active ones. CORE was kind of a hybrid, if you will. There were some whites in the organization at that time who were sympathetic to the cause. And there were also some SDS members, Students for Democratic Society. Dave Boston was the president of CORE at that particular time. And then upon his graduation, I became president of CORE.
What made you want to join CORE? What made that be an organization you selected?
Well, as I said, I've always been interested in politics. I've always been interested in civil rights. But the thing that made me really join CORE was the fact that I could see that I was a persona non grata at the University of Maryland because of the color of my skin. So I felt as though I needed to join a gang, if you will. And CORE was the only gang that I could join. I'm using that term facetiously. But I agreed with the movement at that time. Dr. King was heading SCLC, and one of the people who was the head of CORE at that particular time was Floyd McKissick. And I was an admirer of his work and what he was trying to do in terms of building Soul City in North Carolina. So that made me want to participate. The other reason is because of the housing situation. I've always been interested in fair housing. In Blackstone, Virginia, my family were farmers, an agrarian society, and they had a lot of land in Blackstone. But the federal government wanted to build what they call Camp Pickett because of the war that was looming on the horizon in the 40s. And so they gave the people who inhabited that land and the reservation, there were also Indians who were living there at the time, the Powhatan Indians, they gave them 30 days in a month of December to move out, to find a home, to move all of their personal belongings. And they took their land by right of eminent domain. And there were some whites who were living in that area as well, because in rural areas, sometimes white farms and black farms are kind of located close to each other. But the white farmers got a better deal than the black farmers and black families did. You know, whereas the white families were getting about $600 an acre for land, you know, the black family would get $100 an acre, if that much. And then, if you hadn't moved out within 30 days, they would come, the federal government would come and physically haul your belongings away and set them on the side of the road. And it was up to you to find a place to move to live. And of course, with so many people being moved out at the same time, there was a housing crunch in Blackstone. It was hard to find. And whites had first dibs on any land that became vacant. And of course, they could live wherever they wanted to live, whereas black people had to be relegated to, quote, the sole part of the city, or the sole part of the town, if you will, called the West End. So fair housing had always been an issue with me. And then those members of my family who left during the migration from the south to the north, they encountered a housing situation in Baltimore, where you could buy a house in Baltimore, but you couldn't buy the land. Blacks were prohibited from owning land in Baltimore. So you had to pay ground rent, even though you were buying your house.
So I'm interested in, you talked to me a little bit about how you felt you were received on campus, but how would you describe race relations in general on campus?
You mean today or then?
No, during your time as a student.
Well, the University of Maryland is the reflection of the society as a whole. There were a few liberal people there. Those would be people like the Students for a Democratic Society. There was only one interracial couple on campus that I knew of. It was a Jewish friend of mine who was dating a sister. There was a lot of, I call it white nationalism, being taught in classes, particularly in the history classes. I'll put it to you this way. In one of my history classes, a young white lady said that she was against black people being free because it was interfering with their way of life, their privileged way of life.
Oh.
And in other words, we were there to serve, not to be equal to them, you know. So, and that was the general feeling that I got across the campus.
So I know you mentioned that you didn't attend a homecoming after that first homecoming, but did you feel there was the same reception at any other campus activity, or whether it was a speaker or performer? Did you feel there was still that sort of ostracizing at other events as well?
Well, my favorite places to hang out on campus was at the Arts Building Theater. There was an instructor there named Roger Mearsman. I was always interested in drama. I was always interested in dance. I didn't follow through on dance because during that period of time, if you had an interest in dance, modern dance, ballet, etc., if you were black or black male, they considered that to be the gay gate, if you will. And I wasn't gay, I just loved dance. Not that there's anything wrong with anybody who's gay. I didn't have a problem with that or hang up about that. I just didn't want to be labeled that way. But I had a dance, I did take a couple of classes. I had a dance instructor called Marion Rosen. And she was a safety zone, if you will. I could go into her class and talk to her, and she would be okay. Roger Mearsman, who was head of the drama department, was another place that was a safe haven for me. So I developed a relationship with the two of them. And then I had an English instructor, a lady named Diane Hacker at that time. She happened to be white also. But everybody at the University of Maryland was white at that point, particularly when it came to the faculty, which was another reason to join CORE, because one of the items in my platform was that we wanted more black professors on campus. We wanted more black students on campus. And we wanted more black athletes on campus. There was only about two at that particular time. Kenny Holliday being one of them, who was a football player. Oh, yeah, two. Alvin Lee was another one. Mm-hmm. And then we had two black basketball players when I was there. So I just wanted to see a change.
Okay. You mentioned that CORE did some work around fair housing in College Park. Can you tell me more about those efforts?
Well, the main effort was trying to find places that blacks could go to rent housing. We didn't have much success there. I was also working with an organization called Access, which was trying to bring integration to Montgomery County. Access was the name of the group. The acronym was Access, but it was called Action Coordinating Committee to End Segregation of Suburbs. Mm-hmm. So we would have fair housing demonstrations, but nothing really became of it in terms of people opening up the doors and saying that we welcome blacks. You know, it didn't go down like that. Although it was something that was important in the platform for me, at least anyway.
Okay. Were there other places? You mentioned that housing was inhospitable, definitely to black students in and around the university. What about the eating establishments, movie theaters, things of that nature?
The University of Maryland, in terms of eating establishments, are quite different now. I mean, when I was there, there was Howie's and there was Howard Johnson's. Those were the two main attractions in terms of food, if you will. Mm-hmm. Howie's being a sub shop, and Howard Johnson just being what you see on the Jersey Turnpike. Mm-hmm. So I didn't experience any discrimination there. But there were a few beer pubs. One was called the Boo and one was called the Garden. Mm-hmm. Depending upon how much beer the crowd had been drinking, that would determine how welcome you were there. But it wasn't my kind of place anyway. I'm not a beer drinker. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have the kind of entertainment that I liked, you know. Most of it was along the line of their music, I'll just put it that way.
Okay. You mentioned that you'd gone to some of the fraternity row rushing. Could you tell me more about how you experienced that?
Well, they would invite you out to a rush. It was like an invitation that was extended to the dorm. So naively, I showed up at two or three of them. I think it was three of them all together, Tip and Tyke being one of them, two of the three. And when you showed up, everyone looked at you like, why are you here? And like I said, I came from Baltimore City College High School, which was pretty well integrated, where everybody got along well together, blacks and white. But when I got to the University of Maryland, it was a totally different experience altogether. They didn't know me. So what I'm saying is that they didn't roll out the red carpet.
Okay.
They didn't invite you to join. You could come to the rush, but that was it. You know? You knew you were out of place.
Okay. So eventually, CORE became the Black Student Union. Could you talk to me about that transition, how you all came to decide it was something that needed to be done, and then kind of how the membership or maybe even the campus responded to it?
Well, my My thinking was twofold. First, there was the president's convocation, which we had a demonstration at. You know, this is when the president, who was Wilson Elkins at that time, a real, I'll call him racist, a real racist from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Who was president of the university. And so I decided that we should have a demonstration at the convocation to express our dissatisfaction with the plight of black students on the campus. And during that incident, where we were stood up to walk out, I was attacked by the campus police and some PG County police as well. As a matter of fact, they kicked me in my back, kicked me in my ass, and the student body, the white student body, I guess it must have been about 18,000 people there at the time, in Cole Field House. One of them shouted out real loud, "Shoot him, sir! Shoot him!" And this was as they were kicking me in my ass going out the door and kicking me in my back. And I wasn't the only one that could receive that treatment. So I kind of got into Frederick Douglass state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, power concedes nothing without a demand. And I knew that we would have to step up our efforts if we were really going to get the attention of the administration and the student body, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that was one reason why I suggested the change of name from CORE to Black Student Union. The other reason was that CORE was more of a pacifist organization, a peaceful organization, along the lines of FCLC. And Floyd McKissick was doing a great work, and I knew that we had to become a militant body, and so I didn't want to do anything to hurt the national chapter of CORE and their image, because he was seeking federal funding for Soul City at the time. He was spending a lot of time in Washington lobbying Congress to try to get the funds to build that city. So we didn't want to do anything to tarnish the national reputation of CORE. Because I admired the work they were doing when they were doing the bus rides.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the name came about. I was really surprised. Once we changed the name from CORE to the Black Student Union, we had a lot more blacks who joined the organization at that time. And so we stepped up our efforts in terms of militancy when we became the Black Student Union.
Mm-hmm. So at some point, the Black Student Union attempted to be recognized as an approved student organization. Can you tell me about those efforts and whether it was successful during your time?
First of all, the first thing we were trying to do was get a place, space to meet at. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you have to be a recognized campus organization in order to have that. And that was denied to me specifically. But the gentleman who was in charge of the student union, who happened to be white, who happened to be sympathetic to our cause, and said to me, whenever you need to have a meeting place, let me know, and I will make it happen for you. And so we did meet on campus, even though it was not legally sanctioned to do so. Okay. Then a couple of times we met at this Baptist church down in Lakeland, which is down the road. I don't know if you're familiar with the campus or not,
but
there's a place called Town Hall. But before you, there was like a pub, liquor store before you called Town Hall.
Mm-hmm.
The university has grown so much now, but that was the black part of College Park, Maryland, called Lakeland.
Mm-hmm.
And I got permission from the pastor. They would allow us to have meetings there whenever we needed to. So we had meetings off campus.
Do you remember the name of that church?
Unfortunately, I'll be 77 my next birthday. And my mind did not retain all of that information.
Okay.
A lot of things, because of the pain that I experienced,
yeah,
I tried to push back into the inner recesses of my mind because it was a very painful time. So some of this I have forgotten.
Okay. Well, because there's that part too. How, what year did you enter and leave the university?
65, I left in 69.
Okay. And so, you know, students who attended school during that time period often had, as you said, painful experiences. How did you, for lack of a better words, how did you keep your head about you during that time?
Well, I attributed a lot of it to my Southern Baptist upbringing,
mm-hmm.
Which was ironic because of the fact that my mother and father separated when I was 7 years of age. And I was living with my grandmother. And I told her that I missed my mother and my father, and I would like for them to get together again.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, well, what you have to do is get on your knees to pray to God, and God will answer your prayer to bring your mother and father back together again. And from this time I was 7 years of age until I was about 15, I prayed that prayer. And then at some point I became an agnostic, I guess you might say.
Mm-hmm.
I stopped believing in God, you know, because God had not answered my prayers, and I'd been praying to him for almost 8 years for just this one thing. But my folks have such a resilience about them. My grandmother and my grandfather and my uncles, they were all preaching, praying, singing kind of folks. And you can't help but be a part of your upbringing. So I felt I felt the need to pray again. And that helped a great deal in terms of seeing me through. And then there was some good people at the University of Maryland that I was on the battlefield with. Robert Blandford, who was my roommate in college. Bobby McLeod.
Mm-hmm.
Another brother named Carlos O'Keefe, Keith from Washington, D.C. And another sister named Josie Bass, who to me was the carbon copy of Fannie Lou Hamer. She didn't take any mess from anybody. She was sick and tired. As a matter of fact, when they were kicking me in behind, she turned around and she just let out a big wad of spit into the state trooper's face, and it was just rolling down. I mean, it was funny, but it wasn't funny at the time because it was painful to me. But that was the type of, she's somebody you want to be in the trenches with. And I have to speak up for the black women who were active in that organization at that particular time. They stood on solid ground. So you had some good black women in that organization, and you had some good black men in that organization. And I attribute that to the fact that that organization still exists today, because it came from strong roots.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not patting myself on the back. I'm just saying that the entire body of students who were in the Black Student Union at that time, they were good people.
So with Core being somewhat interracial, how did those students who necessarily could not be a part of Black Student Union. Do you remember how they responded?
Yeah, well, it wasn't just a case that, hey, you know, you can't come in here. We're mm-hmm. Black and you're white. I still had a relationship with the people from those organizations mm-hmm. because I felt as though it was important. I understood where they were coming from, and they understood where I was coming from. So we always had a good relationship with the other organizations on campus, particularly Students with Democratic Society. Now, Young Republicans, Young Democrats, you know, that's a whole different bailiwick altogether. But they were never friends of ours to begin with in the first place.
So, when you got to the point where you were leaving the institution, do you remember anything of what it felt like to leave the campus for the final time as a graduate?
I didn't attend my graduation. I had them to mail me my diploma. I had no desire to be a part of that university any longer. Like I said, it was a great deal of pain there. And that's what I remember, the pain. Mm-hmm. There wasn't much pleasure other than the people I was working with. And my good friend Kenny Holliday, we were in theater together. So that gave me great joy to be creative, to take your frustrations out in other arenas, you know. One of them being Dorothy Dandridge, not Dorothy Dandridge, but A Raisin in the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
Kenny Holliday was the producer, director of that, and I was one of the principal actors in it. That gave me great joy, so I could get some of my frustration off on those kind of campus activities, if you will. Lorraine Hansberry.
Mm-hmm.
And also that led to me being able to work with her husband, Lorraine Hansberry's husband, Bob Nemiroff, once I graduated from college, doing theater productions across the country.
Okay, well, that does lead me into my next question. What were your next steps after graduation?
Well, my next step was to get a job because I was a poor, poverty-stricken college student. And my mom was working as a waitress, so I wanted to be able to help her and to provide for her, even though I didn't live with her.
Mm-hmm.
I always lived with one of my uncles or one of my aunts, never lived with them. So that was the first thing. And I ended up in Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, heading a, quote, poverty program for young people. And I became active in fair housing again while I was there. In an organization called Housing Opportunity Made Equal. And the reason for that being is because I was trying to buy or rent a house in the white section of Richmond called a Fan. And I was told that they weren't selling or renting to any nappy-head niggers.
Mm.
So I hired an attorney. And I had a white friend of mine to go to rent or buy the same house. And they told her that, yeah, we want you to have the house because some nappy-head nigga just left out of here.
Mm.
And we told him that the house was sold. She had told him that her husband was in the Army and she wanted a home for him to come home to. And so I filed the first fair housing suit in the state of Virginia in federal court, and I won. And then I started promoting concerts. I had the opportunity to work with Patti LaBelle, when they were LaBelle. I did a lot of concerts with Reverend James Cleveland on the gospel side. I did work with Sister Shirley Caesar and the Gospel Caravans, the OJs. I mean, the list goes on. As a matter of fact, I used to do some shows in North Carolina with Kool and the Gang and KG and the Soul Children and War Memorial Auditorium in Fayetteville. I don't know if it still exists there now, but.
What was the name of the auditorium?
It was called War, WAR, Memorial Auditorium.
Yeah, I don't think it's, well, it definitely does it still exist now. But I could definitely look into kind of where it was in town.
It was off of one of the main highways. I mean, that's many moons ago, so I
yeah.
can't remember the location of it. But that was where you went to when you wanted to do a concert when the soldiers got paid. You had to always get your concerts around their payday.
Fayetteville is... Fayetteville hasn't changed that much. It very much, the city operates around military paydays. It's still the same. In fact, we know that when we need to go somewhere, the worst time, if you live on a busy street, is the 1st or the 15th. It's the worst time to go anywhere.
And that was exactly the time. We used to schedule shows there, too, at the same time.
Just
wow,
don't.
Okay.
Yep.
So, are you from Fayetteville?
Yeah, born and raised in Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yep. So I want to ask, particularly because you've been very forthcoming and vulnerable about your experiences at UMD, what possible suggestions would you have for the administration, maybe the faculty, maybe the staff around working to prevent students from feeling that way again?
Well, I don't know that that would be the panacea for what ails them, because like me, when they leave the University of Maryland, they will come out into the larger society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even I thought we were making great progress there, because by the time I graduated, we had more blacks on campus. We had one black professor, Dr. Anyewu, who was in the political science department. He was from Nigeria. As a matter of fact, he served as advisor to us for a minute there. So I thought we had had an impact, that some changes were being made. But then when I look at the young man who was going to Bowie State, who got murdered on Route 1, just for being black and waiting for his friends at the bus stop, like America, ain't nothing changed at the University of Maryland. So I don't think that you can shield them from feeling that way, because when they get out into the larger society, they're going to end up feeling that way again, just as I did, you know? And then there's no safe haven for you to go to. I've been to Africa. You know, I toyed with the idea one time of just getting rid of everything and moving to Africa. But when I go to Africa, they want to know about America. They want to come here. And so there is no place for the black man or black woman, for that matter, to go to in this world. And I'm further concerned because now we're doing space exploration. And the billionaires are trying to build a another home, if you will, on Mars or the moon. And we still haven't gotten things straightened out down here. And as a result of one of the presidents being into office and spreading a lot of hate and poison in the society, I don't see it changing anytime soon. I like to be an optimist, always. And I always try to think positive. But I just don't see the change that we need, where we can truly feel to be Americans, not black Americans, but just Americans, and to be able to reap the same benefits that the whites reap from this society. So I don't think that you can make the students feel good what I found is that sometimes you have to be Martin Luther King and pray for the heathens, for lack of a better term, painful though it be, may be, and sometimes you have to be like Malcolm. You have to be threatening to them and let them know that you're a man and you're not going to take this lying down. And sometimes you have to be like Korah and suffer the blows and arrows of outrageous fortune and insult. And sometimes you have to be like Sick and scream black power and also have a show of force. So the battle is not over with yet. So it's no sense in trying to sugarcoat it for them on campus, but they got to come out here and deal with the real world.
Okay. And so my last question is kind of in the same grain of how you've responded to this one, but if you were tasked, if you were invited to campus to talk to a room full of students, specifically black students, what might you say to them as words of encouragement as they go forward?
You know, I've often thought of that. And it gets back to the black church again. By the way, for a while there, I was a Muslim too. Mm-hmm. I still consider myself to be that in certain aspects of my life in terms of what I eat and how I pray. Mm-hmm. But I can't deny my Southern Baptist heritage because I love the Baptist church. I love the singing in the church. But to answer your question, using the analogy from the Baptist church, is that you just got to keep your hands on the plow. You got to keep your hands on the plow. You can never give up. You can never give in. And you can never quit. You got to keep on believing. Believing in yourself. And we definitely have to spread the fact that black lives matter. Not only to the white population, but within our own race, if you will. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes black lives don't seem to matter. There's senseless killing going on. We need to stop that. We elect politicians who come to us for our vote and promise us. But when we go to them, the best thing that you're probably going to end up getting is some social services center where they pass out food stamps. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but when it comes to contracts, they seem to give all of those to the whites. And the whites are usually the ones that bankroll their campaign to begin with in the first place. Mm-hmm. So it's holding to them. They're not of their own minds. And I see this happen in Maryland. I've seen it happen in Virginia, and I've seen it happen in Washington, D.C. The only exception that I would make to Washington, D.C. is Marion Barry. And Mayor Marion Barry, and they call him Mayor for Life. I had the honor and opportunity to work with him because when I was president of Black Student Union, I used to spend a lot of time hanging out at SNCC's office on U Street. They were an inspiration to me, and they had good leadership there. So I'm beholden to them. But we're just going to have to keep on fighting the good fight and not give up and not give in. And that's the only way that we're going to succeed as I see it. So I don't know how inspiring that would be to them, but I do believe that we shall overcome, with a caveat to it. We will only overcome as long as we continue to fight. That's the only way that we can overcome. We can never give up. Never. We can never allow ourselves to be treated like second-class citizens. And if fight we must physically, then we must do that too. And I'm not advocating for any kind of race war. I'm not a racist. I just want to be and die a free black man. Thus far, I haven't accomplished that. I don't feel like a free black man. When I get in my car, I'm looking over my shoulders, just in case. Sometimes when I'm walking down the street, I'm looking over my shoulder. You can be in the wrong place at the wrong time and end up not surviving that situation as well. You have to be careful about how you send your mail out. If you're going to make a payment on a mortgage, you know, you better not put a Lee and Team price stamp on your envelope. It better be one of them American flag looking things, because you don't know who's going to open that envelope up. And what they can. I mean, that's just how paranoid I am still about living in America. So, but I'm not going to give up. And I would advise them to do the same.
Okay. Thank you so much. That was my closing question, so I definitely want to thank you again for taking time out of your day to do this interview. It was very enlightening.
I feel as though I'm obligated to do it because of the fact that you were one of the things that we were fighting for. And what it seems to me, I don't know the scope of your study that you're doing, but it seems to me that you're shedding some light on an area that needs to have light shed on it. And one of the things that we were fighting for back in the 60s. So you are a symbol of hope, as far as I'm concerned, because of the work that you're doing at the University of Maryland.
Thank you. So
that has to be under trying circumstances, not easy.
Thank you so much. If I have any follow-up questions, will it be okay to reach out again?
I'll be more than happy to, and I'll probably remember a lot of stuff that I didn't remember in our talk today, because, like I said, I put this stuff on the back burner. I try to put it into the inner recesses of my mind, because it can consume you, and one of my favorite poets say, Langston Hughes, it can fester like a sore in a run, or it can drive like a raisin in the sun. And I'm just trying to get the fester, the pus out of this sore of racism that I'm experiencing in America. And I'm not the only one, I know. So it's been kind of enjoyable talking to you, because I've been able to release some of my anger that I still have in me, just talking about it. I make it a habit of not talking about race, politics, or religion with people, because you never know where they're coming from. And that includes black people. I'm surprised at the number of black people I see with Tea Party tags on their car. What are they thinking, you know? I'm surprised at the number of people who supported Donald Trump. Every time I see them on screen talking about blacks for Trump, I don't understand it. I just can't comprehend it at all. But who am I to tell them what to believe or not to believe?
Okay. And if anything more comes to mind, I'm completely open for doing another interview. Just let me know. And so I'm going to go ahead and, end our call now. But definitely, if you remember anything, or if I have any additional questions, I'll reach out, and then you can reach out.
Okay, and I will get you a form back to you before the close of business today.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you as well. Bye-bye.